broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Across the country, thousands of students will be graduating from college. So what does the future hold for the class of 2014? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. This year is expected to be better than any during the Great Recession. One business survey found that employers said they expect to hire 8.6% more graduates from their U.S. operations than they had initially thought. On the other hand, the nation has recorded a record $1 trillion in student loan debt. Take a look at the prospects in our studio. Our guests are Dr. Rebecca Emery. She is the Career Services Director at Salisbury University. And also SU student Austin Whitehead. He is a native of Salisbury and is interning this summer at the PricewaterhouseCoopers in Baltimore, and has also graduated. So, by the way, congratulations. Yes. Well, let me ask, I'm going to turn to Rebecca first, and it's sort of like there's sort of a mixed sense about what's going on here. Because on the one hand, we've gone through this very long recession, began in about 2008, 2009. Things have progressively gotten better. We've seen continued job growth. How do you assess where this generation is, particularly this graduating class of 2014, when it comes to getting out of college and getting a job that maybe that at least is commensurate with the kind of education that they got here?
Well, I think it continues to be a struggle, really. It's hard. We don't see the growth in jobs for college graduates that we would like. The growth in jobs are often in the service industry, which tend to be non-college jobs, low-paying jobs. Hence, I think, the interest in raising the minimum wage, you know, those kinds of things. So it really is, you know, a different world for college graduates. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. But we just have to understand that different world.
How do you compare what things are like now, particularly this year, say, as opposed to, say, a few years ago? Because I was looking at some stats a few years ago, and particularly some of the articles, and this was, like, bleak. It was, I mean, if you got out of college, the chances of you getting a job was real slim, and getting a job that's commensurate with your education or in your particular field was even worse. How do you compare where we are now as opposed to, say, a couple of years ago?
Well, definitely it's got steadily better. But what happens is then the new graduates, like Mr. Whitehead here, is still in competition with those people that maybe weren't fully and gainfully employed back from 08. And, you know, so there's just a lot of there remains a lot of competition.
So I would take you, ask you, well, first of all, how do you feel about your job prospects down the road? I mean, I know you have an internship, but as everybody says, internships are nice, jobs better. Where are you with all this? What's your feeling about where things are?
I believe for myself that my outlook is good. I believe I've set myself up and have taken the steps necessary to put myself in a position where I'll be able to obtain a job afterwards through multiple internships. I've had multiple internships throughout my college career, and I think that really shows going into the job market that you have been in the field a little bit, you've gotten a little bit of pieces from different industries, and you're a little bit more competent as to what is going on, and they like that. That's the one bad side about going into a job is that they like the experience. And how do you hire somebody without experience, which is the dilemma. So picking up those internships, I think, is what has helped me to be as confident as I am going into the future for my jobs afterwards. So this internship with PricewaterhouseCoopers, I feel as though after the internship, I'll be able to take on a full-time position with them after I complete my 150 credits to get my CPA and then go forward with that.
If I could just say, you know, Austin's done all the right things. Those couple of internships are the way into the job market because, as he said, everyone wants experience. We see that. Even sometimes it'll say 1 year experience. Well, a couple internship adds up to experience. And at least 60% of all interns, especially with the bigger firms, convert to real jobs. So it's really, I mean, he was, you know, he landing that job with such a big firm and a prestigious firm is awesome for Salisbury University, right, and for him personally. Yeah.
So, by the way, have you been on other job interviews? Have you been on job interviews yet? Or
Yes, I have. To get the position with PricewaterhouseCoopers, I went through multiple interviews. I went through webcam interviews with the partner. I was asked to come up. I had dinner interviews. I had three interviews back-to-back-to-back with managers and two partners at PricewaterhouseCoopers to be able to land the position. And like we were saying before, the competition is great. I was competing against people from Rutgers, Cornell, University of Virginia, Florida. There's a lot of big schools that we're competing against in this area, in this Mid-Atlantic area. So you have to be, you have to put yourself in a position where you can be competitive. And I think doing internships and getting yourself out there and exposing yourself to what's going on in the world and really being competent with what is happening in today's society is a big part. I remember when I was in interviewing, they had asked me, well, what was your take? It was back when there was a lot of crime going on in Syria. They threw that out there. I'm an accounting major, they said. So what is your, how what do you think about what's going on in Syria and things of that nature? You have to be overall very competent with everything that's going on in the world, not just your particular major per se. So really understanding a lot of things that are going on in the world is something that you need to prepare yourself for.
Being an educated person.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to ask you, Rebecca, because I mean, we've had interns and practicums that they come through here, and they certainly are focused on their particular profession or their particular what they want to do. And a lot of, to be fair, a lot of them say we want to go into sports, right?
Right. Yeah.
that's like the big thing. And I do tell them, I say, well, you need to know more because you never know what the. First of all, if you know more, your job opportunities are going to be expanded. I mean, just right. You know, because there's just so many sports jobs. But the second is that you need to be well-rounded. How significant do you think, Rebecca, that well-roundedness is in terms of particularly interacting with somebody who's going to employ you and the kinds of questions that Austin sort of raised here?
Well, we definitely see, you know, what Austin described, that interview process as being much longer, much more arduous, involving many, many, many more people. And so you get these kinds of questions, you know, what's happening in Syria? Why are manhole covers round? You know,
right, exactly.
Those kinds of things. And I think, you know, we're just not hiring an accountant. We're hiring a person, a partner, a colleague. And so we want them to fit in. We want them to be able to interact appropriately. You know, they took him to dinner for a reason. They wanted to see how he could behave and eat and, you know, not be embarrassing. And,
right.
You know, so I do think being an educated person and showing that, putting people at ease, having conversation abilities is really very important. And we still see the number one skill that people want is communication skills. You know, no matter what industry it is, we want people to be able to communicate.
So how, Austin, before we leave this, how important, did they ask you about your previous internships and how significant was that? How did you lace that into what your response was?
If they don't ask it, my advice would be to put it out there. You want to be humble, but you need to put it out there because it is so competitive. And you need to, if it doesn't come up what you've done in the past, you bring it up in the conversation. Oh, this is similar to something I've done prior. This is similar to this prior internship I've had. I think this is, I could bring something to the table because I did this XYZ in this internship or in this experience, this job experience. It can be anything. You can be a server and just take that teamwork from being a server working in a group of people in a restaurant environment. A restaurant, I've worked in a restaurant before down in Ocean City. It's everything's very fast paced, and you bring that to the table and say, "Yeah, I've worked in a very stressful, fast paced environment. Yes, it's not related to this industry, but the teamwork, the communication that's needed, that's the backbone of what's going on in any environment, in any industry. So having those core values set up is something that you need to stress and you need to talk to them about. They might not ask you about your experience in a restaurant, but you say, what did you learn from the restaurant? What was your experience? What have you gained from that experience? Not just, I made a little bit of extra bucks over the summer, but I learned some teamwork and communication skills from it. So really stressing that to the person that's interviewing you, I think that's very important to do. Even if it's not brought up, you put it out there.
I think you'd make a good career service person. Because, you know, that's really what interviewing has become in many ways is storytelling. Mm-hmm. What's your story? Mm-hmm. And what are those experiences that you've had along the way, whether in class, out of class, in a volunteer situation, through sports, mm-hmm. you know, in the community like you've mm-hmm. been. That, you know, those stories indicate who you are, how you work, what kind of colleague again that you're going to be.
Because one of the things, as a matter of fact, I tell students that job interviews, I tell them that job interviews should be looked at like their press conferences, which mm-hmm. you have a set of basic messages, then they're going to ask you questions, and what you want to do is take those questions and turn them into responses that you want to have mm-hmm. to let them know about. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the sort of the sense I get. Mm-hmm. So what would be, Rebecca, what would be your main points in terms of advising somebody who is going to go into a job interview? What should they know about the company? What should they be thinking about in terms of what they can bring to the table to an employer?
Right. Well, you can't do too much research, you know. So sometimes students say, well, how much is that? I'm like, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours worth of research minimum. You know, they should know everything about the company that there is to know, and not just Googling them, obviously, but we should be reading press conferences and press releases, mm-hmm. What their competitors say about them, their rankings, you know, those kinds of things. Just understanding the kind of firm or organization that they are, and then understanding the job that you think you're applying for. Maybe you can get some insights through LinkedIn and other places on the people that you'll be interviewing with. So that kind of research is very important, because in fact they've looked at you on LinkedIn and perhaps Facebook, they've Googled you, so they know more about you than what you're presenting on your resume or even in a letter of recommendation. And then thinking about exactly what you said, Dawn, those press conference
items
you want to, put forth, and find a way to weave them in, mm-hmm. like you were saying, you know, what can I say? Now, you can't always use them,
right.
but we see athletes, you mentioned sports before.
Right.
I mean, many companies want athletes to work for them. They don't want them to work for them because they're football players or lacrosse players, though that's cool. They want them to work because they can set goals and reach them, and because they're competitive. And so that's what they have to show in those interviews.
So if I were, say, for instance, if I were interviewing you mm-hmm. for an accounting position, for mm-hmm. example, so what kinds of things would you be telling me, Austin?
Well, now we've brought it up before, communication is key. And accounting per se, it's not the same as what it was. Accounting is not, we don't want the person that's straight A student who has that 4.0 GPA that knows the numbers on the dot. We want somebody that can go out and communicate with our the people we're working with, our clients. The main focus of the firm is to bring on clients and for clients to like you and to stay with you. So being an individual that can communicate with people and and all types of people, being diverse and having an array of things to talk about, not just accounting per se, is something that they're really looking for. Yes, they want you to do well in your studies, but they really are looking for that well-rounded individual who can really communicate and connect with individuals and the clients, and individuals in the firm and clients that you're working with. Being able to connect with everybody is more important than just talking. You really have to build those relationships, and I think that's more important to the firm now in an accounting role, and I would like to say in all industries, rather than just the skill. They can teach the skill, but they can't teach you to communicate and connect with people and build your own relationships.
You might talk about some things you guys did in classes, though, in some of your answers, right?
Yeah.
Because you get some really hands-on things. I don't know if you did the auditing course where you... Right.
Yeah. The auditing course, we were put into groups. I was actually asked to be a reviewer, so I would review all of the work of all the interns before submitting it to the clients. But we worked with 8 not-for-profit executive advisory councils that were throughout the area, throughout the Maryland area. And what we would do is we would compile their financial statements and put everything in a row for them. And we would present it to them at the end of the year saying, this is what your summary, this is what your financials look like, this is things you should take as steps to for internal controls, because a lot of these places, we worked with a lot of churches too, and we say for internal controls, we don't believe anybody's stealing, but for internal controls, maybe you should implement this or implement that. But the core thing that you learn from it, you learn a little bit about the accounting, you learn about how to audit, but you also learn how to work as a team and as a group. Everybody has different obligations throughout school, whether it be sports, clubs, anything, work. But you learn to communicate well so you can make the time to meet with one another, and you build on your relationships and you build on your communication skills within these groups. We also do something in another accounting class. It's called Intermediate Accounting 2. It's called a BAM. It's a business activity model where you are given a fictitious company and you have to go through and they have an accountant that's not good at what he does, and you have to go through, fix all his mistakes, and you have to present it to the banks and everything to get loans for different equipment and leases that you want to obtain. Everything's made up as you go. You don't know what's going to come ahead of the game. But you are given this you're given this project to really work as a team to figure, yes, you're learning the accounting as you go, but the biggest thing that I take from it is really being able to work in that team environment and to build on your communication skills.
By the way, now, also, Rebecca, how significant is social media and the internet these days? I mean, I can remember looking for a job about 10, 15 years ago, a little less than 15, and one of the big things that I did not have, say, 10 years before that, was the internet, which was just really coming online, and finding job sites and so on and so forth. How significant is the internet, social media, and how should people use it?
Well, it's really everything, you know. people find jobs on the internet. I mean, certainly, you know, but they find jobs, and then they apply most of the time. People apply to jobs through the internet, so companies can have much more sophisticated systems. They're called applicant tracking systems. So if I'm applying online, I read his resume, I'm looking for keywords. So if I'm looking for JavaScript, someone who does, or Dreamweaver, you know, I'm just plugging those words in, boom, they pop up, and now I have the candidate pool. So keywords become I just can't even tell you how important that is because of this technology that we have available to us. On the other hand, while I, an applicant, am hunting for jobs, over here recruiters are using social media to attract people and find people. So they're using LinkedIn, basically, to link with people, advertising their jobs, promoting what they're doing, talking about new products, anything. And so we see this, professionally. 5 years ago, before LinkedIn was around, you know, we were so worried and continue to be somewhat worried about Facebook, because if you start using Facebook when you're 12, you know, by the time a lot of stuff on your, you know, so how do you make that look professional?
Sure.
And of course, there's been workarounds for that, but students still, or young professionals still, have to be extremely careful. We still see stories of people losing internships and jobs and all that from Facebook things.
Right.
But But social media is, you know, in whatever form it is today, is definitely the main way people find out about jobs, apply for jobs, and so forth. That doesn't mean networking isn't still as critical right. as always, but you got to deal with that other piece.
Austin, so what kind of role did social media and the internet and that sort of thing play and how you were looking out to looking for jobs and looking mm-hmm. for what your field might offer?
Well, I am a Salisbury native, and I did foresee in going through my college career that I wanted to go across the bridge. It is a 2.5-hour drive for me, so being connected to those people, those recruiters that are across the bridge, was very important for me. And because I was in school and the other obligations that I had, I couldn't just make the drive to go meet with people. Using the internet sources, emailing, and the LinkedIns, going and using those resources to help me to connect with these individuals that are across the bridge and to get into these positions that I'd like to was very key for me to build upon those relationships. Also, going to the career fairs was a first start where you get to meet them in firsthand and first person, but keeping that constant communication is key. And really putting it out there what you're doing as you go along, because they like to see progress as you go through your career in college. So they like to know what you're doing. They like to know that you get the internship position and you're stagnant and you think you're going to get a job afterwards. They like to see that you're constantly getting yourself involved into projects that will build upon yourself and to make you a better person.
I mean, I said turning to one of the downsides, which is the student loan debt. I think it's now $1.2 trillion. I ran across one number that says that's triple what it was, say, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And just to let everybody know, I left school in 1970 without any debt whatsoever. And in order to go to a state school, it cost me maybe $100 for the books and about 10 or 15 bucks for some fees. That was it, by the way, just to give you a sense about where mm-hmm. education has come. So I want to turn to you, Rebecca, and to ask you, what kind of issues arise from the fact that these students are coming out of college? They have a degree that puts them certainly ahead of the game. On the other hand, they have this major, major debt. What are you seeing there?
I know the average college student has, the average college student has about $26,000 in debt. It's really actually heartbreaking. On the other hand, So it does require them to do several things. One of the things is I think that people are very careful and should be very careful about continuing their education until they get a handle on the debt that they have. In other words, does graduate school, should it cause you more to go into debt? And I think the answer is no. You should find a way to pay for graduate school and not go into more debt until you get a handle on your debt. The other thing we hear so much about is kids moving back in with mom and dad.
Right.
My son's living with me. there's really, I don't think that's a bad thing in any kind of way. You know, today's families are different than, of course, I'm much older than you guys, but, in my family, there were five of us, or now there's one or two in a family. That's not always the case, but in general, so the houses are bigger, so there's more room to move in. So it's not what it once was. We see college students now are friends with their parents. They seek them for advice. They are very good career counselors in the most part. So it's, and unlike maybe my generation, they're friends with their parents. So, if you can work it out, I'm not saying it's hunky-dory all the time, but I think if you can work it out, it can be a very nice way to help reduce your debt and get on top of it. We have a couple students who are doing some really cool, we have about three students this class going to the Peace Corps, but the same amount doing Teach for America. Those are two programs that your debt is put on hold. Hmm. And even can be reduced in, depending on how you handle other things. So I often encourage people to do AmeriCorps, which is the Domestic Peace Corps. That's another way to get debt reduction and reduced. And we do have a lot of students you know, who all want, I know Austin's doing something really cool this summer. And so it's about giving back to people. And so even though they're worried about their debt, they're also, you know, working, you know, for America and representing America in these ways. So it's really very cool. But it is a problem. I don't ever encourage anyone to go into more debt after undergraduate school. You know, you really want to tread lightly because it can really weigh you down. We hear stories of this.
Yeah, I mean, I've read where people are like in their 30s and their 40s, and they still have this debt that's following
hanging
them.
Hanging over them, yeah.
Well, right. Austin, I don't know how much debt you have, but what how does that weigh on
decision
on your future?
Making?
Yeah.
I've been blessed with the parents that I have and who have been able to help me out through college. But I do understand where the problems come from, $1.2 trillion. And you brought up people living with their families still. My dad, he was born in Barbados. My dad was not born in the country. And I've seen a lot of different types of countries and how and cultures, how they live. And down in Barbados and down in the islands, family is, I mean, a big part. And people staying with the family and living with their family is something that's not is very common. So I think in the United States, people look at it that you're living with your parents. That's not a good thing. But I think for financial reasons, I think it's a positive thing. And I think building the relationship with your family, I think that's key. Having a good family relationship is key too. But going into the future, I think you should definitely really get a handle on the current debt that you have and really not take that with you, because the more you increase that debt, the more the struggles you will have, the more stress you will have having to pay these things off. And just, you know, you have school, but then you have your first home that you buy, the cars that you buy, you start having a family. I would definitely encourage people to limit the amount of debt that they get from school, really assess what they want to do with their lives beforehand. I know there's a lot of people that say go into a particular field and not know what they want to do, so they decide, I'm going to go for more education, and then they still don't know what they want to do. I really think consulting and meeting with individuals in the type of field that they think they might have an interest in is key before continuing that education and continuing to go on. Really consult other people who have done what you want to do. I think the key, one thing I was always told was key to success, figure out what you want, find someone who has and do what they do. If you take that and you have that mindset, you'll no longer be taking a path where you don't know where you're going to end up. If you have no goal, you'll never hit it. So
let me ask you this. Your colleagues, your fellow students, do they worry a great deal about the debt they're accumulating, or do they psychologically kind of put it off until they finally hit graduation and then they have to figure out what's the psychology going on with your generation, do you think?
See, and I think it's a complete opposite of what I just said, that you should be mindful of what's going on, but I think everybody is not thinking about it. They're not thinking. They just kind of put it to the side and go live in college and having a good time and not really putting much thought into the debt. And then once they get there and it hits them and they have to start making payments and things of that nature, that's when the stress really happens. That's when the stress really starts. It's like, wow, you know, this is something real. This is something that I've put myself into without thinking of the consequences going forward. So not planning on the jobs that you want, not planning on what you want to do as a job. You have to be happy too. You don't, and that's one thing. Figure out what you want. So once you get into that job, not only can you successfully pay off that debt, those student loans, but you can be happy doing what you do throughout your career.
I mean, because it seems to me that students are in a squeeze in which you may start out thinking you want to do one thing, you go through college, and you decide you want to do something else. So you're shifting, and all the time you're accumulating debt. It sounds one of the concerns I think a lot of people have is whether or not at the end of the day that you're going to come out of graduate school or graduate from college and all you're going to get is this minimum wage job, or you're going to be in a large number of folks who get out of college, they wind up with minimum wage jobs, which hardly pays it well back. What impact do you see on the in this generation?
I don't know about a large percentage, it is a big impact, but you always have your education, and education isn't, at the end of the day, always about getting a job. It is about knowing about the world, knowing about people, learning more, understanding deeper. And so, you know, I think in the end, that will always be, no one can ever take that away.
Right.
You know, that's what they always say. But it also gives you a springboard. I mean, if you're in a minimum wage job, who are they going to promote? Someone with a college degree who works hard, or without a college degree? You know, so I think you put yourself in a, even if you're working at a job that doesn't require a college degree, you know, eventually maybe you can move up in the management position, because always doing a good job wherever you are puts people in.
Are you concerned that because of the rising costs of education, which is skyrocketing really, that we may be pricing an entire generation, a portion of generation, out of going to school? I mean, I mentioned what I went through. A lot more people, you know, you could afford it, but are you concerned that we might be pricing them out?
Well, I know we are very concerned at Salisbury University of keeping the cost down. Also, we have a huge push on making sure people finish in four. So we want them to finish in four. So when people come to us and they switch their major, we work very hard at trying to figure out how quickly they can make up this, change their major and not suffer because of it and go into more debt. So that's the thing. But it's very hard when you're 18 or even many times 17 coming to college. I mean, you're not even 21 and you're graduating from college. Coming there and say, I want to be, or I'm going to study this, and not because of what you're learning think you'll change. Mm-hmm. But once you get your life rolling, then coming back part-time, going to school part-time, recharging, rebooting.
By the way, just in the last minute we have, I know there's proposals to bring down the interest on some of these student loans. I know Senator Elizabeth Warren has talked about a major piece of legislation that would bring it down almost like 0.75%. We'll see where that goes or not. How significant are those interest rates, do you think, in terms of the students as they go forward? And do you think it's fair? I mean, she's mentioned the fact that the federal government's going to make a whole lot of money, I mean, billions of dollars, off the interest from students like Austin here, who are, say, borrow money. And she says that's just the wrong priority.
I'm really not an expert in that. So, I think it sounds like a good idea to reduce the interest. Yeah,
from an accounting standpoint, I'd like to point out that when you take on a loan, when you're paying it back, you're not paying it evenly. You're not paying the loan back evenly. The first few years, actually more than up until halfway, you're paying a majority of interest first.
That's right,
So say you're making... You have $100,000 in debt, and you're paying $1,000 back each payment or something to make things easier. Your $1,000 payment is not bringing, that first month payment is not bringing it down to $99,000. You're actually paying $800 in interest and then $200 in towards the loan. So really, you've only brought your $100,000 in debt down from $100,000 to $99,800. The other $800 is pocketed by the government.
Do you think that's right, that the government pockets the money? Should they lower it so that
it's
an investment?
I don't think it's right, but it's been going on throughout history. Okay. That's how interest has worked throughout history. So I tell people, when you go to buy a house, I have my real estate license as well. We have a family company, a real estate company here on the shore, Whitehead Real Estate Executives. And I tell people, don't spend up to your limit. Don't buy or purchase a house that you can only, that's the top you can afford. Because what's going to happen is, at the end of the day, you're spending all that money and payments is going towards interest, and you're not paying down that house. It's not, so you need to be careful with what you purchase and what you go into loans.
We've been speaking with Dr. Rebecca Emery. She is the Career Services Director at Salisbury University, also an SU student and graduate, Austin Whitehead, who is a native of Salisbury, and this summer is going to be interning at PricewaterhouseCoopers Baltimore. I appreciate both of you joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
My name is Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I play a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists. Whether it's alt country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa, there's music and interviews with Americana artists from lots of countries that may surprise you. So join me for the International Americana Music Show, Friday nights at 11 on WSDL 90.7.
It's baseball season again, and hopes are high, and the fields are fresh, and the game just waiting to be played. And the Mid-Atlantic Vintage Baseball League, featuring 1864 rules, is keeping that tradition alive. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Well, just a reminder to listeners, by the way, baseball actually reaches back into the early 1800s at least. Indeed, the New York Knickerbockers, founded in 1845, were the first team to play under modern rules. They were a social club, and among other things, they eliminated the practice of a fielder putting the runner out by hitting him with a ball. In 1857, there was a short-lived National Association of Baseball Players, but it wasn't really until 1876 that the Hall of Famer William Hubert actually organized the National League, and of course, the rest is history. As with, of course, the American League, the first World Series in 1903, and of course, the end of what was called the dead ball era, and with the rise of Babe Ruth in the early part of the 20th century. To take a look at all of this, we have with us Chris Nicola with the Arundel Excelsiors. Also, we have Fred Fonts, also with Arundel. And then from the Milford Excelsiors, we have Jim Exler and Jeff Pugli. And I hope I got all those names right there.
Sure did.
A mouthful. And just to give us, just to give our listeners kind of a sense about the how old this game is. I ran across it there in 1828. There was an article that was published in Hagerstown, Maryland newspaper. It describes a young girl who's drawn away from her daily chores by a baseball game. The piece, by the way, is written by a woman named Miss Mitford, and in a thing called a village sketch. And it reads as part and follows. Then comes a sunburnt gypsy of six, beginning to grow tall and thin and find the cares of the world gathering about her. Her longing eyes fixed on a game of baseball at the corner of the green till she reaches the cottage door, flings down the mop and pitcher and darts off to her companions, quite regardless of the storm of scolding with which the mother follows her runaway footsteps. That's just to give you a sense of what, and that was in 1828. So let's start with one of you. I'll let whoever wants to jump in here. And give me a sense, by the way, about this. How does the league this get started in terms of the Mid-Atlantic? Anyone? I'll just pick. Okay. How about Chris?
Yes.
Yes. How did this get started?
And our team is actually fairly new. The Arundel Excelsiors was put together, I think, about 5 years ago, with just a group of guys that enjoyed to play the ball, and none of them. had actually played and organized a game. They just had found the league and said this, they wanted to put together a team, and so they gathered six more players, and that was that. And they looked up the rules, they talked to other teams, and they started to play, and that was it.
Jim Exler from Milford, what? How did you get into it?
I got into it playing for a team out of Lewis. Jeff and I started playing with a team in Lewis that was part of the Mid-Atlantic Vintage Baseball League. Most of it was done as a reenactment. Mm-hmm. I do know we have a tournament up in Gettysburg to do like the Civil War reenactors. They have a tournament up there. But a lot of it was just to go out and have an athletic club that you would get some exercise and a form of enjoyment and just camaraderie playing with one another. Most of the game was invented or was really took off after the Civil War when guys would come back and then they formed them as athletic clubs. So a lot of the clubs are set up as that.
Hey, Jim Exler, how'd you get involved?
Go ahead, Jeff. I'll let
I'm sorry, Jeff.
I go to Cooperstown once or twice a year, and I was up there maybe 4 or 5 years ago and had seen a group of guys playing ball with no gloves and obviously throwing the ball pretty hard. They had old uniforms on, and I started asking them, you know, what are you guys doing? And they explained to me that they have a vintage baseball league. They were out of the Connecticut area. So I did some research on it, and there's actually a vintage baseball association out of Minnesota, and there's about 400 teams across the country that participate in this type of baseball. Some use 1885, some use 1865. Different years have different, and different eras have different rules. So I looked in Delaware, and when we did find a team, and Lewis was putting together a team, I went down and asked Jim if he'd come down and play, and we started playing with them in the first year and then thought, well, we could branch off in Milford. We had enough players that played softball that we thought we could put a team together that would enjoy traveling across the East Coast, playing this old type of baseball. And last year was our first year we played. I think we went 29-3, and
right?
Guys had a really good time playing it. They enjoyed traveling and meeting other guys in the sport. But it's historical, but it's also very athletic. It's not so much reenactment anymore as it is still a game, and boys play it, and they want
to
win.
You're out there to okay. That's I assume, by the way, that nobody throws the ball to hit the runner out.
Soaking doesn't happen anymore. No.
Fred Frost, what about you? How did you get involved?
One of the founding members called me and asked me. I was close friends with him. He said that he was getting a team together. I grew up playing baseball. I've always enjoyed the history of the game. So he told me that it was something that I'd enjoy, and I decided to give it a try. It gave me a chance to really learn where the history of the game was. It kind of takes us back to a nicer era, an era where it wasn't about money. Mm. So I enjoy the camaraderie. He told me that I'd really get to know the history of it, which I've learned a lot that I hadn't known before. So it was just a good chance to kind of further my knowledge of baseball.
So I guess the next question is, so how do your rules differ from, say, modern baseball? Anybody?
The rules can be strange at best. Wherever the ball hits first is what it is. So if the ball hits in fair territory first, it is a fair ball. It doesn't matter what it does. If it hits 2 inches in front of home plate and then goes back 100 feet, it's still a fair ball. You can catch the ball on the first bounce, and it's an out. We do not have gloves, so that's sort of one of the reasons that if you got a line drive, you could smack it up and then catch it off the bounce or whatever. Then there is stealing. Pitching is done underhand. It's done from 45 feet. You can't windmill. You can't swing your arm around, but you can bring your arm back and throw it as hard as you want, but your catcher has no equipment. There's no masks. There's no shin guards, no chest protectors, and no gloves. Those are just some of the simple ones. As you alluded to before, that the game, you used to be able to throw and hit the runner out.
Right.
You can't do that now. It's a tag. But by the same token, today you have to hold and grasp the ball. Back at the time, if you just had the ball and tagged somebody out, it didn't matter if you controlled it after you touched them. Once you touched them, they were out. You don't have to tag up on a ball that bounces, but you do have to tag up on a ball that is caught in the air. One of the other rules is on a foul ball, you cannot advance until the pitcher has the ball again. So you have to go back to your bag. You can't overrun first base, so stopping at first base. There's probably all of us will tell you that we have some type of leg issue trying to stop all the time. Hamstrings are definitely, and fingers are the two things you have to look out for the most.
And the most fun you'll have is bringing a new player to the team that doesn't know all the rules and let them play a game. Because it's quite fun watching them over on first base and get tagged out. Or when they're batting, they don't call the arbiter, which is our umpire, doesn't necessarily call balls and strikes all the time. He's allowed to make a no call. So if the pitch comes in, he thinks it's not a hittable ball, but also not a ball. He'll say no call, and the pitch is done over again. So it can be frustrating. The games can last longer if the arbiter chooses to widen the strikes when they're not widening it. So you get up there. It's a hitter's game. It surely is.
It's still hitting. Because one of the things that I just mentioned in the introduction is there was a thing called the dead ball, which I guess does not exist anymore. I mean, in terms of an actual baseball. So, because my understanding is that particularly as you hit in the 1920s, they changed the ball. I think it was called a rabbit ball. I think at one point, and it really was sort of a hitter's
game.
More
lively, yeah.
Yeah. How does with those existing rules? And obviously, you all play baseball. Modern rules. How does that change the game in terms of you still obviously have this fast ball, as it were, a hitter's game, but at the same time, with these rules, that seem a lot more restrictive than you would have thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Baseball then was just forming, so they didn't they didn't have time to think through all the rules or deal with the modern equipment that's out there. So as you can see over the years, the rule books change every year from the 1950s through 1900. The shame is, I'm a baseball historian. I go back, most of my studies have always been up to 1900 when live balls started.
Right.
Gloves were out there, and you know those names, the Christy Mastersons, Ty Cobbs, but you don't know much about the guys that played in the 1800s. And I always partly say it's because their baseball cards didn't come out till 1885. But even those, there were cigarette cards at the time. But we don't have that. History is really not out there for that 1850. To 1890, and we've tried to do research on our club, and we only found one article from, what was it, Jim, 1866, where Milford declared themselves world champions and hadn't played a game yet. So Diamond State, which is out of Wilmington, came down and quickly beat them up pretty bad. And the scores back there were in the 60s to 40. Yeah, they were high-scoring games. Back at the time, you know, people didn't train for baseball like we did today. A lot of guys that play our game have played ball in high school or college, and so we know the game a lot better. Back then, people just learned the game. So scores were quite higher back then. I think the game was 63-10 or something.
The other thing is three balls and you walked, three strikes and you were out. Foul tips don't count as anything. And if you walk, everybody on base moves up. So if there's just a man on third, and I walk as the striker or the batter.
Yeah.
I walk to first, he walks home. So everybody moves, no matter what. It's like you get a single, like you get a base hit. So it's an interesting game. To Jeff's point, the games can take 2 hours to play, or the games can take 45 minutes to play. It just depends on the two teams, and defense is king. You know?
Yeah. Because you're going to score runs. Most teams can score runs. It's just, can your defense hold the other team down?
Mm-hmm.
And we do play nine-inning games. So they're right. Nine-inning. We usually play doubleheaders, so two nine-inning games. And for old guys like Jim and I, you know,
enough.
It wears on you. You need to have those extra players to come in. You know, some clubs... Arnold's got some young guys on their team, so they're...
Well, as a matter of fact, you're young and all, and what attracted you to the idea of playing by these rules? I mean, I know a lot of folks who play in baseball leagues and so on, and I mean, when I was in Los Angeles, there was the press corps versus the staff or the local supervisors or whatever, and we go out and play. But so what attracts you to this particular kind of... And do you play the other kind as well at the same time? Or you?
I grew up playing modern baseball. I don't play that anymore.
Yeah.
I've always been attracted to the history. I like the history. I enjoy going to Cooperstown and learning a little bit more about the baseball. But something unique about this is how fundamentally sound your team has to be in order to be a truly successful team.
What do you mean?
The modern game, if you can hit for power, you can be a great team. And that doesn't quite work the same way because the balls are so much softer, they don't travel as far. So to be a team that plays good defense and can hit ground balls and can steal bases makes you a truly elite team. So you don't have to have the best players on the field on any given day. You have to have the best core group that works together. So you may not be the Albert Pujolses or the Ken Griffey Juniors of the modern league. You may be just a bunch of guys that are average that work well together. And that can win you a championship in our league.
Jim, you've got the balls there. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about these.
So we brought in two baseballs, one from 1864. Mm-hmm. It's a replica. It's a company that makes them for us. And you can actually keep that if you'd like. And then I also brought a baseball from when I played Little League.
Much harder.
Maybe 10 years ago. So the balls back then were basically rags that were tied with string. Mm-hmm. And that's for the ball. So that's actually not nearly as tight as... That's actually way more tight than what they would actually play with. So and then over time... They made them stronger and more tighter so that they could be played. And as batters got more practice and they got stronger and they got, could throw it harder and hit it harder, they had to have the ball be wound tighter. And, of course, as the 1900s came in, they had to have them tied by machines. And there you have our baseball now.
So what does that, you're all hitters. What does that do in terms of when you get at bat, it's not like a regular baseball where you hit it and if you hit it right, it's going to let go long distance. Well, what kind of distance do you get out of a ball like this?
You can get over 300 with these. Yeah. The problem becomes when the ball goes over the outfielder's head, they still have an opportunity to put an out, meaning it bounces, the ball will bounce, and they can still run under and catch it. And Red's a great example. He does it all the time. You don't want to put the ball out to a good left fielder because no matter how hard you hit it, he's fast enough that he'll run underneath that bounce and catch it.
So even with a softball, you can get some. Do you feel? I mean, because both of you have hit. Is it? Do you get a different feel when hitting the ball does you have to hit it harder in order to go further, or what's that like? Take me through that.
You have to hit the center of that ball.
Uh huh. Okay.
If you do not hit it dead center, it has a chance to egg out a little bit, and the ball will go straight up or straight down. Hmm. If you can find a dead center of that ball, it's like hitting a regular baseball, but you have to find a dead center. You can't be off a fraction of an inch.
Now the other big difference that I really like, and this goes to going to a ball game, is when you hit a real baseball nowadays, there's that crack that everybody knows, that crack of that bat. You could be anywhere in a ball field and you know that ball was hit. When you hit our balls, there's no crack. There's no crack at all. It sounds like hitting a bunch of rags. There's no sound to it.
More of a thud.
Yeah, it's very distinguished. Yeah.
But one of the difficulties that comes with our ball is many people don't hit it square.
They hit
on the top or they hit on the bottom. And as we play a game, that ball is no longer a sphere. It turns into an oval. It turns into an egg. So it makes it harder to hit, and it also makes it harder to field.
It does. Yeah. If you hit underneath of it and it's spinning backwards, that fielder, that ball typically spins right out of his hands. And you run everything out because it's hard to make it out.
And we only use one ball per game.
I was going to ask you.
We don't change them out. That goes back to the history of the game. The balls, obviously, back then were very hard to come by. They were expensive in the 1800s. So the game ball was used, and they never changed them out. And the game ball becomes a trophy ball. So when the winner of the game gets to keep the ball and usually decorates it, puts a score to game on and a date. We found in my collections, I go back and look at balls from even the early 1900s in the Milford area, and we were able to acquire some balls from 1936 where Milford had beat another town team, and on there they have the scores and the dates and where they played the game. So they did it even up until the 1930s. They used the balls as sort of trophy balls at the time, but by then they had to use interchange. You foul the ball off, they would have to use another one.
Yeah, right.
Our games, we have guys running into bushes, and Rising Sun has a swamp in left field. You need to go into the swamp and get the ball, bring it back out, because the rules are we use the same ball, and we never destroyed a ball that we had to change out. But
the next game you just have a new ball then
for the second game. And on our fields. Also are a little different. We don't use manicured fields. For instance, there's no dirt on our fields. It's simply grass fields, even around the bases. It's grass. Home plate is usually a disc. We try to use a rubber painted disc because stepping on it with modern cleats today, the plastic cleats, you can really hurt yourself stepping on that plate and sliding.
Sure.
But they were typically metal discs back in the 1800s that they used for home plate. And then typically sawdust canvas bags are the bases, and that's what we still use today. Sawdust bags on the bases for them, but we don't manicure the fields. Some fields are very nice. We're playing in county parks. Other fields, we're playing on farms, and you still have divots where cows may have walked. And we go to Gettysburg, it's literally a cornfield that's been chopped down and grass is on it, but it's not a flat field by no means, and there's a lot of leg injuries. because you're stepping in. But that's how they played back then. You know, they didn't have the modern tools, so they played wherever they could. Some fields are shorter than others. Some have trees in the middle of the outfield.
Is that right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it just brings a different feel to the game than what we've played growing up.
Rising Sun, one of the places we play.
Where is that?
Jerusalem Mill in Maryland.
Okay, okay.
They actually have a house that almost lines up with first baseline. And we've had some players hit the house. And we have to have ground rules. At the beginning of every game, you get both captains together and the umpire, and you go over the ground rules. There have been instances where the outfield, beyond the outfield, was tall grass. Well, if you hit a ball in tall grass, you may not find it. Or you may take you a few minutes, and the guys may run around the bases. So we made a house rule for that game. If you can't find it, if you lose the ball, you put your hand up, the bases will get the next, the right. runners will get the next run, and then you could continue on. Same with a tree in the outfield. If the ball goes into the tree, you're going to treat it like a man-made object. You catch it out of the tree, and it's an out. Or it bounces once, and you catch it in and out. So there's house rules for every field that you play on. Our particular field, we have a street at the very back of the outfield, and then we've had players hit it beyond the street, and just like the tall grass, you put your hand up and the runners will get the next base.
So I'm going to go around, and so we're going to start with, I'm trying to get all this, yeah. So Jim, yes, right? So what position do you play?
I play them all. Oh, yeah. So I'm the captain of the Milford Excelsiors, so I line up where everybody else is going to play, and then whatever the spot is that we need. Yeah, I try and keep everybody at a position they're used to. I figure if our shortstop's not there, there's no need to move the third baseman and the first baseman and have five guys out of position.
Right.
I'll just play short. I'm obviously not the best shortstop on our team, but, you know, as the captain, I just try and do what's best for the team. So typically, I play anywhere.
And Jim, what do you play?
Jim?
Jeff?
I'm typically in the infield. I'm not, as you can see, my body size is not necessarily meant to be an outfielder. So they typically keep me in the infield or catcher. It's not bad. I'm used to playing infield. So, you know, Jim puts me at third or short or second. Yeah. You know, to me, it's all good. Just being on the field and playing is a lot of fun. We do play a lot of softball, so the rules we can mess up every now and then, and we try and keep that in order. But it's different playing without a glove than playing with one. I like it better without a glove. You have a better feel for the ball coming in there, and it just feels more like playing the old vintage game. I prefer playing the vintage baseball over softball any day.
Jeff is a really good third baseman, but we've had some younger players come onto our team, and Jeff has graciously let them play third, and he's moved over to play second or some other things. But he's obviously one of our better power hitters.
I would think that these, I mean, particularly ball, I mean, the ball is obviously softer, but nonetheless, it's going a fairly fast clip. I mean, does that, as opposed to playing with a glove, do you at the end of the game, do your hands feel a little?
I'm going to knock on wood here. Seasons, I have not hurt my fingers. and I have had balls, you know, line drives, and you just try and knock them down. It's really just when that moment that ball's coming to your hands, if that your fingers are just down far enough to get hit with it. Jim will attest. Jim's broken fingers three times.
Yeah. So. Is that right?
This one right here and this one.
We have a lot of guys that have bent
fingers. I can see. It comes with the game.
Yeah. And we were talking about it before, and that we've had players that have to retire or stop playing because of broken fingers.
Yeah.
And it's just the nature of the game. And as you were saying, it's more fun. It requires more skill to play with no glove. It sounds like it wouldn't, but I mean, you don't have a place to put the ball when it's coming at you at that fast, because it's got to go in your palm.
Right.
If you think about the size of gloves and how much space you have to get that ball into that glove, now you're talking about the distance between your thumb and your middle finger. Mm-hmm. And then if you don't catch it right off the bat, which most of us will probably say we don't, you got to pick it up out of the ground, and then you got to find a place to fire it away.
And we have a little ribbing that goes on with the outfielders.
Yeah.
If the ball's hitting the outfield, and normally you'll let the ball bounce and catch it, because it makes it a lot safer, obviously, than catching a 250-foot ball. And, of course, if they let it bounce and catch it, we consider it not manly. So you'll hear that from the other team. If you're in the outfield and you let the ball bounce and catch it, we prefer our outfielders to do that so they don't hurt themselves. But you'll hear ribbing from the other team saying,
not very manly.
Yeah.
And that brings up another topic about the vintage baseball that you don't hear about, is that there was a lot of discussion between the teams. There's a lot of, I want to say trash talk, but it was playful. It was fun. It was you laughed about it. You laughed together. You're a bunch of guys, that could wail on each other on a verbal level and not get hurt by it. It was fun. And so we still bring that out. We still do that occasionally, and you try to have fun with it, and you kind of have names for each other. And that's another part of the game is each of us have nicknames that are derived from maybe a part of how we play, or a visual stigma, or just an item that you may have said or done that sticks out in someone's mind, and they give you a name. So every one of us here have a nickname that we go by.
Okay, just real quick, what's your nickname?
My nickname's Five.
Five, why five?
So Fred might be a better person to describe the story the name.
Basically, when he joined the team, we asked people to give themselves personal ratings.
And
he rated fairly high in everything. So we said if he was a five-tool player, we'd call him Five. And if he wasn't a five-tool player, we'd call him Five.
So, yeah. And Fred, what's your nickname?
I'm Bones.
Bones, why Bones?
I have a history of breaking bones. I broke my hip when I was 13.
Okay, and next one here.
I'm Swamp Donkey. And I still don't know why they call me Swamp Donkey.
Maybe you're just lost on the swamp. I don't know. What can I say? And Jim, what about you?
I have two. I have the nickname that was given to me, and I have the nickname that
you chose. So give us.
I'm Preacher, and then a lot of people on the team call me Tater. Cause I guess I'm shaped like a potato.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we've been speaking with Chris Nicole. And let's see here, and Fresh and Fred Fonts, who is with the Arundel Excelsiors, and then we have Jim Exler and Jeff Puglia, who is with the Milford Excelsiors, and we've been talking about old-time baseball, which sounds like a great deal of fun, but it also sounds like it requires, not to put any distance between modern players, a lot more precision, whether it's hitting the ball or catching it. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
And there we are.
All right.
Cool. That was a lot of fun.
Day, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on Pack 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pack14.org.